Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House Transportation Committee meeting. Today is 1:14 on February 24th. I have my phone on silent and on not vibrate. Let's all share in that effort. Today, as I said, is Thursday the 24th. Members present are Representative Drummond, Representative Kronk, Representative Stutes, Representative McCabe, Vice Chair Hannon, and myself, Representative Hopkins. Let the record show we do, in fact, have a quorum. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Leah Frazier, and our LIO moderator, Leo Beadle. Are there any... Steedle. Thank you. Rhymes with Beadle. Are there any questions before we move on to today's business? Doesn't look like it. So today's meeting, we're going to have two pieces of legislation, followed by the wrap-up for Ferry Week and the presentation from Alaska Marine Highway Systems Workforce. Our first order of business will be taking up public comment on House Bill 296, dealing with donations and gifts for DOT signage from Representative Rauscher. Representative is with us today with his trustee aide, Ryan McKee. We will take public comment on the legislation and then look to the will of the committee. There is a response to the Department of Transportation and PF on questions posed to the committee that has been posted to BASIS. If we have any, and included in the bill packet. There were no amendments to this piece of legislation received by my office. So Representative Rauscher, Mr. McKee, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and go ahead and make any comments before we open public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Rauscher, District 9, and I appreciate the committee hearing this bill again. I think it's a very good bill, and there are families that that do want to donate money for a project and not have the state pay for them, and this will enable them for the DOT to have receipt authority for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Are there any questions for the sponsor or for DOT about their process in this? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spoke to the sponsor of this one before, but I didn't follow through. Sorry, George. I'm curious what the process is going to be. So if I say I'm going to pay for this sign, and so everything's ready to go and you're just waiting for my dough because it says that you're not going to do anything until you receive my money, and I walk out the door and get nailed by a car, what happens to that sign, that signage, or the naming of that bridge?
Representative Rauscher, would you guys like to take a stab at that or call DOT up to the...
I'll let DOT have that one.
All right, sounds good, Representative.
Name it after you.
Right.
We'll name it after you.
Just as long as it's not in memoriam.
Mr. DOT, please put yourself on the record and answer the question.
Mr. DOT, wow. Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, through the chair, Representative Stutes. You did broach this topic before, so it was an interesting one for me to contemplate and look at. I did look back at the last several years of naming bills that were put before the legislature, and I did find some interesting examples. I don't have it in front of me now, but anecdotally, I'll let you know that there have been a couple that have zero fiscal notes on them and were tied to either projects that were anticipated or ongoing at that time, and hence a zero fiscal note because the cost of that was going to be rolled in. But to try and answer your question, there was one that was for a future project the signs will be placed. So in AS 3540, the designation of the name was placed, but the signs for that were for a future project at that site. And so it would be something akin to that. The designation that is passed in that bill for naming goes through. It's on the books. The signs themselves are placed once there's funding or once there's a project. And should the scenario come to pass that you said where, for some reason, whatever that is, the third party is unable to provide those funds, that name is still in the books, and any future project where signs might be replaced is the time that that would then reflect that that naming.
So if it's like George said, it's Bridge 39, and it's going to be the, I don't want to say in memoriam, but it's going to be named the Stutes Bridge or whatever it is. It's just going to stay Bridge 39 until something else transpires, which would require signage?
Through the chair, Speaker Suits, that is correct. And or another option, which I think I kind of gave a notion of last time, if something were to happen to that third party and it was unable to fulfill its obligation for whatever reason, if the language was left in the naming bill that a third party and it was open to who that was, that can help with those kind of scenarios. You can find an alternative third party, or obviously, we could look at a change in who that name would be if it was a specific person down the road, because again, the designation is there. But I would encourage folks that make naming bills in the future, if they want to go this route, to leave that possibility open. I think you raise a valid point that could be mitigated simply in how you draft that bill.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is how it could be determined that after a certain period of time, I mean, if you go through the whole process and you get it through both bodies that you're going to name this bridge, whatever it might be, you don't want all those efforts to go without. So, I mean, maybe a time frame of if it hasn't been paid for within a certain time, the signage would go up regardless. I don't know. But I would think that there could be some kind of caveat that would allow that bridge to be named regardless under a circumstance of when something happens to the third party.
Again, through the chair, Representative Suits, that is the contemplation of a future project at that site. It would happen. In fact, I just worked with a senator in the other body that was expressing a concern that a particular building did not have the name that was dedicated on it. And in researching that, found out that I don't think funds were provided to that signage, and so it was waiting for that next project. And come to find out, it is having a project this summer where we affirmatively said it will have that new name that was designated and is on the books. So there are circumstances where either that is the intent or is something that if it's on the books, it will get taken care of the next time that there is signage. In the intervening time, if there was something to trigger DOT to have to pay for it in lieu of, we obviously wouldn't have that budgeted, and that would come out of our M&O budget, which, of course, meets a vital need in the state.
One more follow-up?
Yes, ma'am.
Chair, thank you. So if it's a bridge, and then they're going to go and retop the bridge or put a new layer of concrete, then the sign would go up at that time?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, that is one example where, again, a project at that site could very well include the signage. Yes.
Well, I guess that'll just have to do with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair. Thank you, Representative. But this is basically just gives receipt authority. That's all this does. It doesn't give all the different situations you can come up with inside the bill when you want to name a bridge or a road or a section of a road or a project or whatever you're talking about. All this does, if a family thinks that they feel devoted to the person that they want to name that bridge after, they can get a legislator to support that and bring it forward, and they want to be able to, the DOT now has receipt authority to take the money.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions?
I'm sorry, that was George Rauscher, District 9.
There you go. Voice is recognizable, I'm sure we can understand that. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've gotten a memo from the department that, in my recollection, when Representative Rauscher introduced the bill, I think we asked a question about could you donate the sign, and it was sort of like, no, you're donating the money. But in reading the response from DOT, it actually says in step one, the donor can provide a gift in the form of materials necessary to fulfill the requirements. And I'm just, I don't want it to be a conflict, but I also know having, dealing with a different state department about sign requirements, differing versions of what sign requirements and whether that material is the right material and whether that steel meets the steel requirements has taken a year to unravel, and we still don't have signage on the Funter Bay Cemetery where we believed we had compliant signs that had already been donated. So tell me about that ball of wax or those signs going up, because money is money, and assets with dollars are easily, even though the cost goes up. Tell me what the department contemplates with materials donations for a sign.
And through the chair, Vice Chair Hannon, that, again, very good. That was, I helped pen what you were reading. And indeed, the language as it is right now could contemplate materials provided. And I think that just goes to my understanding in reading this was that this allows for more options for people. And options would include the ability for a third party to pay. And it also, in the form of donation of funds or materials, you are spot on that when you say that there are very technical requirements when it comes to signage in our MUTCD, which is the Manual on Uniform Control Traffic Devices, and that follows some federal requirements. It is very precise in what how those signs are produced. If we were going to get into a scenario where someone wanted, that's again the MOU. If we were going to get into a scenario where someone wanted to donate materials, the MOU would very much stipulate, here are the specifications. This is exactly what we'd need. Here are some of the vendors that we would see. I can tell you the department would much rather produce that to the specs that we know work and accept funds. But as the language is presented now, certainly you could work with a party, but we would be very clear on what those specifications would be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. I think I asked that question in relation to a spray-painted car door for the sign last time. I'm glad that won't work, no matter how much we love our cars. So at this time, seeing no further questions from the committee, I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. Public testimony is open. Do I have anybody online for public testimony? Seeing nobody online for public testimony on this, is there anybody in the room who would like to testify on this House Bill 296? Seeing none, going to go ahead and close public testimony. Public testimony is closed. Thank you, committee members and public, for having us move along. At this point, as Representative Rauscher, is there anything else you would like to say and wrap up for your legislation?
No, I do appreciate, thank you, Chairman Hopkins. This is Representative Rauscher, District 9. I do want to thank the committee for hearing this bill. I really do. I think it's important. There's a family that does want to donate some money, and they don't want the state to pay for it. They want to, this is their service to their relative that they would like to bring forth. It won't happen this year, obviously. The AT passed this and left, so that bill won't be able to draft it this year. But anyway, I just hope that this committee can be able to pass this piece of legislation to allow these things to happen in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. At this point, with no further questions, at this point, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Chair Hopkins, I move to advance House Bill 296, version 32-LS1441/A from committee with attached individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, we'll go ahead and take an at ease while members sign the committee report. Welcome back, Transportation Committee. So at this time, we are going to move on to our next item of business, which is House Bill 322 regarding Alaska Marine Highway System Funds by, as a bill by the House Transportation Committee. It is the intent of the chair, me, to hear a brief presentation on the legislation and then set the bill aside. Presenting this bill on behalf of the committee will be Carrie Crocker from Representative Stute's office. But first, Vice Chair Hannon, may I have a motion to bring the CS before the committee?
Chair Hopkins, I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for House Bill 322, Work Draft 32-LS1501/B as our working document.
Is there an objection? All right, hearing no objection, we have adopted the committee substitute. Thank you, Vice Chair. Now that the document is before the committee, Mr. Crocker, would you come up to the table, as you already are, put yourself on the record, and present the new CS?
Good afternoon, Chair Hopkins, members of the committee, Carrie Crocker, staff to Speaker Stutes. The CS before you today is House Bill 322's committee substitute. Creates two funds, the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund and the Vessel Replacement Fund, in the state treasury. And by doing that, it makes those funds not subject to the constitutional sweep under Article 9, Section 17D of the Alaska Constitution. Funds subject to sweep must be available for appropriation reside in the general fund. By making these separate in the state treasury rather than in the general fund, they're not subject to the sweep. And I mean, that's really all the bill does. Ongoing critical state services such as the Marine Highway shouldn't be destabilized by the sweep. We rely on those funds. The gross revenue from those funds goes in the Marine Highway Fund, and that stabilizes the system by maintaining their budget at a modest level. So we always know we're going to have those funds to rely on, and we can get our schedules out ahead of time and do those things that we need to do to stabilize the system and keep it consistent.
Thank you, Mr. Crocker. Additionally, we also have Michael Partlaw from Ledge Finance if there are specific questions. Are there any committee questions for the bill presenter? Representative McCabe.
You have the thank you, through the chair. Do you have the legal analysis from Ledge Legal when the bill came back?
Well, through the chair, Representative McCabe, I do not have that, but I can provide it for you.
Thank you. Through the chair, follow up.
Certainly.
This is totally against the Alaska Constitution for designated funds. There's no possible way that they didn't give you a memo that said that this was legal. Just my statement for the record, this is a designated fund, and our Constitution says that we can't do that, if I'm not wildly mistaken. So I'd like to see that, if we can get that. Is that possible?
Yes, Representative McCabe, we'll go ahead and make sure that if there was a memo attached to it, we will go ahead and circulate that to the committee before the next hearing. Not being lawyers in the room, I think we can avoid that question until we get back here, because I would certainly disagree on the way the funds would be appropriated and spent, but let's go ahead and let bygones be bygones until the next committee on that point. Are there further questions for Mr. Crocker? Okay. Seeing none. At this time, I'll find my space in the script. Let's see. We have no further business on that specific item. So we're going to go ahead and set it aside until the next committee. And we'll bring this bill up again next week, hopefully at the Tuesday meeting. And any amendments are going to be due by my office on Sunday, February 27th. Again, so the amendment deadline for the bill we just heard is Sunday, February 27th. Our final piece of work today will be a presentation from the various entities representing the workforce of our Alaska Marine Highway System. With us today in the room and remotely are Shannon Adamson of the International Organization for Masters, Mates, and Pilots, Erling Wally of the Inland Boatmen's Union, sorry if I've messed that name up, Ben Goodrich of the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association. So please come on up to the table where you already are. Thank you very much. And you can begin your presentation as soon as we get it up on the big screen. That being said as well, I believe we have some – do we have people online as well? I think I have them in front of me. Okay, great. We will have people online who can go through this
and add their 2 cents when we get to their part. Just 1 second, please. I'm going to go ahead and take a brief at ease as we get the technical difficulties worked out. All right, welcome back, House Transportation Committee. At this time, please, ma'am, with the presentation, put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation. We should all have it printed out. Looks like we all do. Okay, great. And it's in front of us on the big and little screen. Put yourself on the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Shannon Adamson, for the record. I am the Alaska Regional Representative for Masters, Mates, and Pilots. One of the other members who's supposed to be sitting next to me today is Ben Goldridge. He had a family emergency and is unavailable. But on the line should be Erling Wally, who's the regional director for the Inland Boatmen's Union. Just as a quick introduction, I've been the representative for Masters, Mates, and Pilots for about 7 years. Previous to that, I sailed with Alaska Marine Highway System for 7 years from an entry-level third mate deck officer all the way through a chief mate. And then I'm hoping Erling can introduce himself as well.
Good afternoon, Chair. My name is Erling Wally. Been a merchant mariner since 1997, working in the private industry till 2006 when I came to work for the Alaska Marine Highway, resigned from the system in 2020, and was elected as regional director in the fall of 2020.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, again, for the record, this is Shannon Adamson. So the slide that you see before you is a way to kind of get a conversation going regarding our numbers and what we do. So what you're seeing is the numbers for the unlicensed department. To give you an idea what each of these departments does, the stewards department does customer service, maintaining passenger amenities, provisions and supplies, food and beverage service, stateroom service, and just in general taking care of passengers and crew as well as emergency duties as assigned. The pursters are involved in customer service, ticketing, financial transactions, crew and passenger info services. They're also the designated medical persons on board, and again, other emergency duties as assigned. That's going to become important as we keep going. The engine department maintains all the equipment on board the vessel, as well as engines and the daily job of keeping the vessel running, and again, emergency duties. The deck department is involved in loading, unloading, tie up and let go, deck side maintenance and emergency duties. The permanent.
Hold on 1 second, ma'am. Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Could you, so they have it on the record, please describe what unlicensed means as opposed to licensed?
Yeah, of course, through the chair, Representative Hannon. The unlicensed department, although they still have specific Coast Guard qualifications, they don't have a license that allows them to serve in the higher level positions, such as the third mates, second mates, third engineers, and second engineers, all the way up to chief engineers and masters. The differentiation is in the Coast Guard requirements for those specific levels.
One follow up?
Certainly follow up.
Mr. Wally is online, but when he said he's been a merchant marine since 1997, so that is a Coast Guard licensure, but in this presentation, he's speaking to an unlicensed crew position.
I'm going to see if Erling can answer that one for you.
Through the chair, Senator Stutz, yes, I am speaking as a unlicensed representative.
Thank you. Just wanting to clarify, because within the industry, when you say unlicensed, that sort of implies there wasn't governance, but those positions, stewards and pursers, still carry merchant marine credentials. That is a licensure from this perspective of the legislature, but within the industry, they're not the navigation officers and the engineers. So when you say licensure, you mean a fairly high level of skill within the merchant marine industry, but everyone from the steward on up are licensed merchant mariners.
Would it be okay if I clarified, sir?
Yes, ma'am. Put yourself, yeah.
Back on the record, sorry. Yes.
No, you're good.
Shannon Adamson for the record again, through the chair and Representative Hannon. You are correct. The difference between the unlicensed and the licensed differentiation is, although qualifications are required for everyone across the board, the licensure for the upper levels, the third mates all the way up to the masters, requires very specific Coast Guard testing that is different than the qualifications and certifications that are required for the unlicensed divisions. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Good answer. So we are on the permanent license. Crew count,
which is perfect. So again, for the record, this is Shannon Adamson. So what you're seeing here is the licensed crew counts. So for MMP, which is the deck side of that, what we do on a day-to-day basis is navigation, supervision for loading and unloading, stability, life-saving and navigation equipment, basic monitoring and maintenance, vessel security, deck side personnel issues, any car deck issues, to a certain extent, some passenger issues if the unlicensed department is not able to handle them themselves, emergency coordination, and other duties assigned. And then I want to make sure that I specify that the difference between the MMP and the engines department, so the deck department and the engine department, is that our captain, who is the highest ranking person on board the vessel, the ultimate responsibility for the whole vessel and what happens to that vessel falls on the master. And then just a little bit, normally Ben would cover this one for me, but just a little bit for the MEBA, is that the MEBA is responsibility for any startups and shutdowns, fueling and oil transfers, maintaining and repairing all machinery from generators to sewage tanks to main engines to bow thrusters. So anything from that is a shipboard system from bow to stern that has machinery or plugs in is the responsibility of the engine department.
Representative Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've covered the MMP, covered the MEBA. What is the IBU? What is their responsibility of their members?
I'm sorry, through the chair, Representatives, Stutes. Is it okay if I just reread a section?
Yes, ma'am.
So the stewards' responsibilities include customer service, maintaining passenger amenities, provisioning and supplies, food and beverage service.
Hold on one second, Ms. Adamson. You want a clarification?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Well, you're
fine. That's okay. What's the overall area that the IBU covers? You don't have to give me the specifics. Is it the, you know, like the kitchen or?
It's probably easier if Erling answers that one, but let me give you a kind of a broad overview.
Okay, great.
So the unlicensed division is in charge of anything that has direct contact with the passenger. So food and the stewards department, which is the making up of rooms, and also the loading and offloading of the vessel, the engine department being a little bit different, but generally that is their responsibility. But I'm hoping Erling can answer your question better than I can.
Mr. Wally, put yourself on the record and answer the question.
Erling Wally through the chair. Could I get it repeated, please?
Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what overall, what is the umbrella that the IBU covers? I see that, is it the unlicensed crew? Is it that's what I'm not quite clear on.
Okay, through the chair. Okay, Representative, I think I understand. So the IBU is all over the vessel, right? We are in the galleys. We are in the engine rooms assisting the engineers. We are in the wheelhouse. The deck department helping, you know, we steer the boats. The mates tell us where to go, and we go that direction. Also, just loading and unloading car decks, ship maintenance. So we're all over the boat.
And then if it's okay, can I clarify something?
Yes, ma'am.
So Shannon Adamson, for the record, I wonder if what Representative Stutes is asking is which part of IBU is covered in this. And that is the entire unlicensed division, which is the previous slide here that does the stewards, the pursers, the engine, and the unlicensed deck departments.
Thank you for that clarification, Shannon.
Oh, look, they have little logos and because they're bullet points next to them. Representative McCabe.
Chair Hopkins. So for Representative Stutes, the MMP would be Stormy, the IBU would be you, and the MEBA would be your engineer.
Thank you.
That
was easy.
what I wanted to know was the IBU has some unlicensed folks in the engine, engine department. How do they go cross union? So when they obviously start out as wipers or whatever the unlicensed part is in the engine compartment. And then they want to go to an engineer type of thing. How do they, is there a way to do that? Can they go cross union? They have to quit the IBU and join MEBA? Is that how that works?
I'm going to let Erling answer that question. He's going to answer it much better than I will.
Okay.
Erling Wally through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yes, so you start out as a wiper, and then you get more engine room time, you get your oiler rating, your QMED qualified member of the engine department, and as you earn more time in the engine room, you're able to test higher to get higher licenses or like your thirds, at which point you can transfer from the IBU to MEBA.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Wally. Voice in the sky. Ms. Anderson, please proceed. Oh, sorry, Representative Hannah.
Thank you. Just so through the chair, in this presentation, you have numbers next to both unlicensed and permanent licensed. Are those the current number of members in the unit, or are those the number of positions in AMHS? I'm looking for... how many are vacant, or is this just the current working membership of the unions?
Through the chair, this is the current numbers as of 2022, the number of people that we currently have that are members that are sailing in these positions. If you're looking for vacancies, that's actually a little bit further in the presentation.
Thank you.
Oh, there it is. Thank you very much. Please proceed. I believe we are on the full-time entry-level minimum qualifications.
Okay, perfect. These requirements that you're seeing before you are to get a permanent full-time entry-level position with AMHS. I want to make sure and emphasize that these qualifications do not guarantee you full-time year-round work. What it means is that you can take a permanent position in a specific department. For this one, we used an example for stewards. Some of these qualifications involve Coast Guard training with pool training and firefighting. They're pretty intense. One of these requirements, which is the transportation worker identification card, requires a federal background check. Another one involves deploying a marine evacuation slide. These are pretty detail-oriented and hard to obtain qualifications, and this is just to work as an entry-level steward with AMHS. I also want to emphasize that AMHS does not in any way assist with you getting these qualifications when you get hired. You are responsible for getting them on your own. The unions have suggested that there be a way to assist new hires in getting these qualifications, for example, a training fund for new hires. We've had these kind of conversations and suggestions with the state for a while now and haven't gotten anywhere with them quite yet. And then I wanted to see if Erling wanted to add anything or clarify.
Through the chair, no, I don't. That's great, Shannon.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, so this next slide, this was me doing some research on Workplace Alaska. This was the closest that I could find to an approximate dollar an hour that would be comparable to an entry-level steward position at about $18 an hour. I'm going to go back and forth just one time. I want to make sure that you guys can acknowledge the difference between what it takes to become a full-time steward as opposed to what it takes to become a full-time office assistant one.
Ms. Anderson, my quick question regarding the previous slide to this slide, are all of the many bullet points on the previous slide, are all of those required to get checked off before you are applicable for a entry-level position? Do you have to get all of those things or just one of them? If I'm going to be at the bar, do I need my TAMP card, or do I need everything else also?
So in order, these qualifications are not necessarily to get hired as a seasonal employee with AMHS. All of these qualifications are required to be a permanent full-time crew member with AMHS as a steward.
Thank you.
Okay, so then this. There we go. So full-time deck and engine department additional minimum qualifications. So these qualifications that you're seeing are in addition to the previous slide that was the entry-level steward's positions. The steward department is generally how you get hired into the unlicensed department with AMHS. If a member wants to advance into a deck or engine department, these are the additional requirements to get a full-time permanent position within those departments. So again, to emphasize, these are in addition to those previous qualifications.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And again, we're going to stick with a building theme here. So in order to advance to the highest level positions inside the unlicensed department, these are the qualifications that are required in addition to the previous two slides. In order to get to these level, there are additional Coast Guard certifications and in some instances Coast Guard testing. And again, this is just to give you an idea how certification heavy AMHS jobs are.
Thank you.
And now we're going to get into the licensed division. And just to clarify Representative Hannon's point, the difference between unlicensed and licensed is that the qualifications and the testing certifications regarding the licensed divisions are significantly larger. So this is an entry-level qualification for a permanent engineer.
Representative Suits has a question.
Thank you. So we're going into the licensed portion, which is not the IBU.
Correct.
So I have a question for IBU. I'm a huge fan of the Marine Highway System. I believe in it wholly, and I guess I have to question some of the motives or some of the reasoning for some of the decisions made by IBU. And what I particularly refer to was a couple of years ago when we were really on the edge and trying to save the Marine Highway System, and the IBU chose to go on strike. That just about did us in, and I'm wondering what their reasoning was.
Either Mr. Wally with the IBU on the phone is willing to answer that, and if you wanted to explain the bargaining process that got to the strike as well, and the steps that you have to go through with public employment, that sounds great. But otherwise, feel free to answer that question, Mr. Wally.
Erling Wally, through the chair, representing the students. We had been bargaining with the state of Alaska for over 2 years to get a contract, and it was also within two different administrations. So when one administration left and we started bargaining with the new administration, we had a few setbacks. A strike is just another tool to use, and we felt that at that time no one wanted to do what had to be done, but we were still not seeing eye to eye, and we needed to get the state's attention, the administration's attention. We didn't want to affect anybody who was, any passengers that were affected. But it was not an easy decision that the IBU made at the time. I'm hoping we never have to go down that route again. But after 2.5 years of bargaining where we weren't getting anywhere, we felt we had no other choice.
Mr. Wally, this is Chair Hopkins, and you guys are under the Public Employees Relations Act when it comes to bargaining here in Alaska, correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. So in order for you to legally be allowed to strike, you have had to negotiate for a long time, come to an impasse that both sides agree that you are at impasse on, then you have to go to mediation, then you have to either fail that mediation or fail a ratification, then you have to go to arbitration, and this is the process that I'm familiar with, and I don't know if your arbitration is binding or non-binding. I guess it would be non-binding because you do have the opportunity to go to strike after that. So then both sides look at what the opportunities for that arbitration are. We have a third party deciding a new opportunity, and then from there, the state would have to impose their last best offer, at which point you would have the opportunity to strike after all that time to take that serious question. Is that the process that is necessary for you to go through?
Sir, no, it is not.
Okay.
We do best and last, and we did reach an impasse, and that's why we went on strike. We had an arbitrator or mediator come in afterwards to help the state and the union sit down and hammer out a deal.
All right, thank you. Follow-up question from Representative Stute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you went on strike, and then you had the arbitrator come in. Is that what I heard you say?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, yes.
Well, I'm just going to make a statement here because I don't want to berate this issue. But being the Marine Highway was in the situation it was in, which was dire straits, clearly, I wonder what the wisdom was, not only the wisdom in your actions, not only on behalf of the state, but on behalf of all the employees that are in IBU. I still, it's been, what, 2 years, and I still think of that. And I've dealt with the other unions involved in the Marine Highway System. And from what I can ascertain from the other unions, they want to be a part of a solution. And somehow I just don't get that warm, fuzzy feeling from the IBU. I'm sorry. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McCabe?
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So just so you both know, I just came off I was a negotiator for a union. We negotiated a contract for 7 years. We were under the Railway Labor Act, which you guys probably know nothing about, but maybe you should. And you cannot go on strike until you reach an impasse that's an impasse that the National Labor Relations Board says is an impasse. So they have to be involved at the end. They have to do mediation, arbitration. And when you finally reach an impasse, you have a 30-day cooling off period. Then there's the last final and all that sort of stuff. So airline contracts are much like the ferry in that if you lose an airline to a Cordova, say, if Alaska Airlines went on strike, they don't have any service. Well, it's the same thing with the ferry. So maybe if this kind of thing continues where we go on strike after 2.5 years, maybe we should put some legislation in to put the ferry system under the Railway Labor Act. And that would resolve some of these issues and maybe force us to, instead of the unions, and I'm a big union fan. I've been a union member for 24 years. But public sector unions have leverage that private sector unions, trade unions, don't. In that when they shut down the ferry system, they shut down public transportations. When they shut down the police department, they shut down policing. I know
they don't have a right to strike.
They don't have the right to strike. I get that. But teachers, same thing with teachers. When they shut down teachers, your kids don't go to school. That's the problem with this whole thing is there is no, in my industry, if I negotiate too much of a contract or too high of a contract, I kill the golden goose. Here, that doesn't happen because it's a public sector union. They know that they can shut down the state ferry system. Sorry, I'm probably way out on a limb here, and I'm probably going to get ostracized. But point being, they have leverage that a trade union doesn't have because they are operating in a monopoly. There is no other ferry system to take their place, and we need to figure that out as a state and as a union if we're going to go forward and have this ferry system actually be a viable entity for us.
Representative Hannon.
Mr. Wally, has the leadership of the IBU changed since the strike 2 years ago? And could you describe that for me?
To the chair, Representative Hanna, yes, we are under new leadership. Jay Ubelhart is now the president of the Inland Boatman's Union of the Pacific and stationed in Seattle. That's where our national offices are. And I replaced Trina Arnold as regional director in December of 2020. After the strike, we all made a concerted effort on both sides to start working more amicably with the state of Alaska and with labor relations. We have set up JLRCs. We have an actual working dialogue with the Department of Administration and LR. We have actually, I think, moved quite a bit forward in trying to mend what occurred in 2019.
Great. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Wally. And I know that those strike votes are not taken just, you know, at the first step, as you described. You had to go through a number of years of bargaining, number of official steps that you had to go through. And then are you able to say if it's public information or if you remember what the percent yes vote was within that single inland boatman union bargaining unit for to take that strike? Do you remember if it was a 75 or a 51% threshold that you reached that was the result of that vote to go to strike?
I don't have that information in front of me right now.
Thank you.
But I can look it up and provide it to this committee.
That's okay. You don't have to do that at this time. I just wanted to know if you remembered. It is not a decision they take lightly.
It wasn't taken lightly, and it was, I believe it was over a two-thirds majority.
Great. Thank you. And when was the last time before that that the IBU went on strike?
With the state of Alaska, I believe it was in the 70s. I know that they had a strike with Crowley, with MMP and IBU back in the mid-80s.
Thank you. So it's not a thing that happens all the time, and we all remember what was happening with the marine vessels, with the marine highway system at the time that you did go on strike, and it was certainly part of a larger picture. Thank you very much. Ms. Adamson, please proceed with your presentation.
Okay, great. So for the record, this is Shannon Adamson. As Representative Stutes mentioned, we are transitioning into the license department now. So what you're seeing in front of you are the entry-level qualifications for a permanent full-time engineer. So this would be a third assistant engineer. Some of these qualifications are going to be the same as what you've seen in the previous slides. These ones do not build on those, but this is the entry-level qualifications for a permanent full-time third engineer. Some of them are going to be the same. So the transportation worker identification card, the basic safety training, for example, the things where things are going to differ and you're going to see a lot more structure and a lot more requirements are officer in charge of an engineering watch, management of electrical and electronic control equipment, and engine room resource management. And again, just to make sure that we're specifying, these entry-level qualifications are not something that AMHS does anything to assist you in obtaining. Okay, so this is where we hit my sweet spot. This is the stuff that I'm a little bit more familiar with. This is MMP's minimum qualifications. So these are the qualifications for an entry-level permanent third mate job. Again, you're going to see a lot of similarities between this and the licensed engineering departments, but some differences include radar and ARPA, flashing light, Morse code, and GMDSS, which is a global maritime distress signaling system. So I want to use myself as an example right now. So I graduated from the California Maritime Academy with a degree in marine transportation, a minor in global studies and maritime affairs, and a third mate's unlimited ocean license. And just to make sure you guys understand what that means is that got me hired with AMHS. It did not get me a permanent full-time position. All of these other requirements that you see in front of me are what got me a permanent full-time position, specifically pilotage, which kind of leads me into my next one. So if you're looking at the screen, you're going to see a video that rotates through MMP's pilotage areas. So this is everywhere that AMHS operates that the Federal Coast Guard requires pilotage for vessels over 1,600 tons in restricted waters. So to obtain pilotage, you need 8 to 12 observer trips through each of these specific areas that you'll see pop up under the screen. So for places like Auk Bay in Southeast Alaska or Kachemak Bay up in Homer, the trips are relatively easy to get. The ships go there pretty frequently and the areas are kind of small. If the ships, the trips that are harder to get are places like Stevens Passage North and Dutch Harbor, which are not frequently visited and take more time riding to get there. In fact, in light of the Testaminas delay, the trips to get in and out of Dutch Harbor are going to be extremely difficult to come by in the near future. So to draw pilotage, what you have to do is recreate these charts that you see in front of you in less detail, but you get the idea. You also have to do a written exam that shows local knowledge, including channels, depths, aids to navigation, tides and currents, weather conditions, vessel traffic considerations, anchorages, and more. And again, to specify, this is for each and every one of these areas that you're seeing in front of you. So for an entry-level third mate, you are required to have at least a primary area of pilotage for the vessel or area that you're bidding. So again, using myself as an example, it took me about 4 years to get my pilotage completed to the point where I was very useful and could take a permanent full-time position on a vessel. As you're going to see us use Washington State Ferries as a comparable for a lot of this. As a comparison, Washington State Ferries, you only are required to draw about 8 to 10 charts. And in order to get the trips to do that, it takes you 1 to 2 days. Again, for us, the grand total of what is required is 49, and it takes you at least a few years.
Thank you very much. Ms. Adamson, just before I get to you real quick, you're using Washington State as an example. Obviously, the Washington State is almost specifically within Puget Sound, so a much smaller, softer, easier boat trip than what we have. I'm not familiar with a lot of the other rural marine highway systems and ferry systems within the nation, but I know that Maine is one that we share some of the infrastructure dollars coming with. And so I assume that might have a harder route or two. that's more like Alaska, so maybe I'm wrong. But do you know anything about the Maine qualifications, the state of Maine's qualifications for being serving on their fairs?
Chair Hopkins, the short answer to that is not specifically. Okay. I can give you a small amount of information in that Maine's ferries tend to be significantly smaller than ours, and the license and tonnage requirements are what dictate federal pilotage.
Okay, thank you.
But I can get you some more information on that one.
Thank you. That's not necessary. It's okay. I don't need the follow-up. Representative McCabe, do you have a question?
I do, thanks. So through the chair, pilotage, is that a Coast Guard certification?
I'm sorry, yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, it is.
So, and do they have different levels of it? I mean, or are you an apprentice? How do you get? So I think what I hear you saying is you're not full time, but you're part time, and you can over the 4 years you can get your pilotage by taking trips. So it's sort of like an apprentice almost in the pilotage program, kind of. Okay. That's clear as mud. Thank you.
Do you mind if I...
No, go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator, Representative McCabe.
Sorry.
You are correct in that it is sort of like an apprenticeship program. The AMHS still uses you in an entry-level security position that does not require pilotage while you get that. Once you obtain those specific charts, they get attached to your license. And as your license grows, as you continue to advance your license, they remain attached to your license as long as you continue to sail those waters. Did that answer your question, sir?
Thank you.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. Yep. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Adamson, so someone who is the captain on an AMHS vessel, would they need to carry all of the pilotages for Alaska? Or let's say you're the Tustamina captain, so you only need Prince William Sound and Southwest Alaska. But since we interchange routes with many of our crew, I am curious whether most of our current captains have pilotage certification for all of Alaska or just for the route they're currently working?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, in most instances, they have pilotage for the route they're working. However, they are asked to move to different vessels or choose to move to different vessels on a regular basis. The Kennecott is one of the few vessels in the fleet that requires pilotage for everywhere AMHS operates, which means all 49 charts. That is the only vessel inside AMHS that requires it as a condition of getting a permanent bid on that boat. In most instances, the crew members bid onto a specific vessel, have the pilotage for that vessel, and then a little bit more. Very few have all 49.
And through the chair, in addition to the all 49 includes the Washington State pilot, because those are vessels that are going to perhaps run from Bellingham to Whittier and
yes.
then periodically out to Dutch.
Yeah, through the chair, yes, you got it. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does your organization also represent the pilots that board the cruise ships, for example, that come to Southeast Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, we represent the AMP, the Alaska Marine Pilots, mm-hmm. The Southeast Alaska Pilots Association, which is, I'm assuming, the one that you're referring to, they are considered independent contractors. So most of the members of that group choose to maintain their membership inside MMP. They are not required to, or we don't hold all of their membership.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Oops.
Yes, that one.
There we go. Thank you. Advancing again from those previous slides regarding the third mates and the third engineers, this is the chief mates and the masters. So this is the highest levels that you get inside those departments. I want to draw your attention to the fact that it takes multiple Coast Guard tests and years of sea time to advance to these levels. This is not something that you can do after one summer with AMHS. These are 10 years in the making type of advancements. So I also want to explain what is the point behind us showing you these requirements. The point is that these positions are not filled by people off the street. It takes years of training and financial investment to get to entry-level positions. And then for the license group, it takes years of training in classrooms, on ships, or a degree from a maritime academy to advance further than that. Again, the reason that we're showing you this is to explain that qualified mariners are an investment. So I know you guys have seen slides from DOT that show our retention issues. These mariners are sought after, and they're finding other jobs with other companies, and we're losing these investments.
Representative Deuce has a question.
Could that possibly be related to the fact that we diminished the runs in the wintertime?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, yes, that is a large factor in retention. The fact that the employees don't have a year-round paycheck plays into that one significantly.
Hmm. I'm a pretty smart gal. Thanks.
There you go.
No argument.
That's why we have you on Transportation Committee.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
Okay, sticking with the license division, these are the license bids versus vacancies that Representative Hannon was talking about. So this way you can see the total number of people we have in each position plus the amount of vacancies for each level. We should also, one of the things that's not reflected on the slide is we should also have about a 30% relief pool that we do not currently have. As you can see, MMP only has three people above the total number of positions. MEBA is a little bit different in that they use a hiring hall, but their permanent positions should be somewhere around 67, and they're currently at 58. We've heard DOT present that they would like to run the Tasleena and the Columbia this summer. By their numbers, not our calculations, by DOT's numbers, we would need 112 master's mates and pilots members and 80 MEBA members. So it's probably an understatement to say that we are seriously shorthanded from being able to run the Columbia and the Tasmania this summer. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. Representative Stutz.
I just was curious through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious if these numbers reflect the individuals that you'll be losing this spring to the pilots.
You read my mind. Through the chair, Representative Stutz, you were correct. These do not represent. There's approximately 4 to 6 members that I am currently about to lose to the Pilots Association. MMP is about to lose to the Pilots Association. And then you'll actually see in a small bullet point on your slide, we have 13 members that have chosen to start training with the pilots that will be leaving over the next 4 years.
Thank you. And what is the bullet point on the bottom? No crew currently assigned to the Hubbard. Does that mean the Hubbard cannot run?
Chair Hopkins, what that means is that while the Hubbard is currently undergoing her, I don't want to say repair, her retrofit, they have pulled all of her crew off, which we still believe there should be crew assigned over there that get to know the vessel while it's in transition, but they have the right to do that. What I wanted to draw attention to was that the Hubbard should get somewhere in the ballpark of 6 MMP and 6 MEBA members assigned to her when she goes back on the run, which is supposedly sometime this fall. So that's an additional 6 per licensed bargaining unit that we are short.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
And I'm actually going to pass this one over to Erling.
Chair Hopkins, Erling Wally in the Wilmington Union. So just to be clear, there's always a few vacancies in each department as, vessels are tied up. People transfer from one boat to the other. So there's always a little bit of a vacancy, depending on what vessels are being run at the time. These numbers also reflect the Columbia and the crewing on there as well.
Thank you. Mr. Wally, are you able to, I don't know if you have the slide deck in front of you, are you able to provide some round numbers for these pie charts? They show ratios, but not the numbers. And if you can't off the top of your head, I understand that, having a lot of numbers flying through my head.
Chair Hopkins, yes. I do not have those numbers. I thought Shannon had plugged them in to create the charts.
If you could maybe just provide those with us for the Excel spreadsheet you did for this, that'd be great. Thank you. No problem at all.
Yeah, I apologize. I was supposed to include those numbers.
Understandable. Yeah, that works. That's okay. No worries. We see the percentage, and that's also critical for understanding the shortage that we have. So just go ahead and send those to me or my staff after this, and that'll be great. Yeah, Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. Could you explain what bids means in relation to vacancies?
Yeah, of course, through the chair. Representative Drummond, a bid is a – is the closest representation that we can say is it's a permanent full-time position. However, that does not guarantee you permanent full-time year-round work. So a bid is you are assigned to a specific vessel in a specific job class. The catch being that if you are assigned to a specific vessel that is not sailing, that job class can be removed from that boat while it's in yard status.
Okay, so follow-up. So the bid is initiated by the employee?
Yes, although through the chair, Representative Jones. The bids are created by the state of Alaska for positions that need to be filled per, in most instances, the COI, the Certificate of Inspection, which the Coast Guard requires. They put those jobs out for bid. They say that these jobs are available, and the crew members choose to take them based off of their qualifications.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So are these standing bids, or is it they put them out 3 times a year, 6 times a year, once a month? How often does the state put those out? And are you locked in? Are there any bid locks? So if you bid for one vessel in one spot, are you locked in there for a certain period of time before you can bid out to another vessel?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that actually varies per bargaining unit, so I'm going to let Erling answer that one to start off with.
Thank you. Mr. Wally, would you like to take a stab at Representative McCabe's question if you heard it? Otherwise, you can repeat it.
Yes, through the chair, Representative McCabe, we have bids put out every 4 months, every 3 months. You are locked into a bid per the contract language for up to 6 months before you can lateral. There's timelines depending on if you're upgrading or downgrading and how many times you can lateral to another position. So there are rules in the CBA we don't want to encourage that. We'd like people to stay where they're at. But they do have the ability over time to transfer to another vessel. So 4 times a year, and they do have the ability to lateral, but there is some rules as far as how often they can do it.
That sounds good. That agreement, I deal with those in my day job too, so I understand sometimes getting stuff where you don't want to be for the ease of placement and filling the needs makes sense, even though it can certainly be a struggle. Representative McCabe had a follow-up.
Just one follow-up. So how about bumping? Can you can you be bumped out of a bid if a boat goes into dry dock or layup for a long period of time? And if so, what's the pay structure? And I know you're going to get into pay a little bit further on, but do you retain your pay in one boat while you're on the other boat, or do you retain the higher boat's pay? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it all depends on what department you're in and what your bid is. So you can be bumped. If your vessel goes into yards, you have the ability, when we're in reduction of force, to bump another person in.
Mr. Wally, it sounds like we lost you on the phone. I still have you online, so we didn't lose you totally. But hopefully he's still there. He just shows disconnected. All right. Well, Mr. Wally, hopefully you is able to call back in. Feel free to text in Ms. Adamson if you'd like. We'll take a brief of these real fast. All right. Welcome back to House Transportation. We are going to proceed as Mr. Wally calls back in and finds another phone. Ms. Adamson, please proceed. We're on the 2015 to 2022 retention trend. There you go.
Okay. Again, for the record, this is Shannon Adamson. What we were trying to show in this slide is two things. That you can obviously see the downhill slides, and they've been going on since 2015. We need to do something to take corrective action now, whatever that looks like. I also want to draw attention to the fact that this downhill slide has been starting since 2015. This is not the pandemic and the mariner shortages that are currently being seen are not in direct relation to this. I think they exacerbated the problem, but it was not the what started the downhill slide.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I'm sorry. I'm trying not to look at my phone, but Erlington thinks
fine.
Back if
okay, great. Questions. Welcome back, Mr. Wally. But for right now, we're doing okay. You don't have any questions to answer. So, Ms. Adamson, please proceed.
One of the bigger questions that we want to address or trying to answer is, why do mariners currently work for AMHS, and how do we make it so that continues? So right now, the reason that you work for AMHS, and this applied to myself when I got hired up here, is the schedule. So what you get is a two-week-on, two-week-off, or week-on, week-off schedule, which is rare in the maritime industry. What it gives you is the ability to have a better home and family life while still being a full-time employee that works 168 hours a month in a sailing job. So to compare that one to a regular shoreside job, a typical state office worker would work about 40 hours a week and 160 hours a month. We do this entire job while working 168 hours a month and 42 hours a week. So it is still a desirable schedule, but you're never going to get a mariner who doesn't work more hours in total than a shoreside individual does. So this means that AMHS employees put in a two-week assignment what a regular employee puts in per month. And this is before daily overtime. So these schedules, which are the reason that you work for AMHS, they increase the likelihood that you'll be home for special occasions or at least closer to them. And what we're seeing is that the increases in callback and holdover due to manning shortages are making it so these schedules are not as available as they have been previously. So if the reason that you work for AMHS is the schedule and you're not getting the schedule, you can make more money elsewhere. I want to make sure that Erling gets an opportunity to talk about the Southwest schedule if you would like to.
Thank you. So just before we go there, this is something similar to Ms. Adamson to a two-on, two-off for the North Slope as well, but with pay that doesn't compete with other places as much, but you get the flexibility out of it. Understood. So, Representative Hannah had a question before we move to the voice in the sky.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Adamson, you alluded to it, but I want you to complete that thought and statement, which is, in the private sector merchant marine world, what would the schedule look like?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah. So in a private sector world, you actually end up working approximately in offshore instances, you end up working 6 to 8 months at a time and getting somewhere in the ballpark of 4 to 6 months off. But you also make approximately double what you make at AMHS as a licensed deck officer. So the schedule is a little bit less appealing. I think that's me putting that mildly. But the pay is significantly better. So that is one of the things that is tempting people to work in other offshore companies.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want Mr. Wally to discuss this aspect from the IBU perspective?
I'm hoping that that Erling can cover the Southwest schedule, which is just a little bit different than the Southeast.
Gotcha. Mr. Wally, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Put yourself on the record and talk about the Southwest schedule.
Erling Wally, IBU, Chairman Hopkins. So the Southwest schedule is a little different. With the IBU, they're one person crews, right? So it's one crew system. So there's only one person who's a bid holder on there, and you're on that vessel, and you kind of you have the flexibility of making your own schedule. So a lot of our members work 4, 5, 6 weeks at a time. Some of them work 2 or 3 weeks on and then take 2 weeks off. But usually you'll see people out there working for anywhere from 4 to 10 weeks and then taking a month and a half off. So we have what you call A days or ATO. You're basically paid time off. So every day you work out in the fleet on the Tuscamina or the Aurora, you gain hours on your time off or your regular days off. So that's why the mariners work out. It's more along the lines of traditional sailing, right, where you're going out for months at a time. MMP does not do that up there. MEVA does. They work a four-week rotation, whereas the IBU, where we work as long as we want to, and then we request vacation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wally. Please proceed, Ms. Adamson.
Thank you, Shannon Adamson, for the record again. So the appeal in working a Southwest schedule specifically for IBU is that you get your control, you get your freedom to determine to a certain extent what your schedule is. So this is what the schedule does for you for AMHS. It gets you the ability to control your schedule or a predictable schedule that does not have you gone for months at a time. That is why people work for AMHS. That's why I got hired with AMHS. I like the idea of having a two-week on, two-week off schedule while still maintaining my larger license. Again, that's rare in the industry. Okay, so now that we've explained...
Oh, hold on, Ms. Adamson, Representative Stutes.
Shannon, what exactly is your license? I know, I don't think you've been specific yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Through the chair, Representative Stutes. So my license is actually in continuity because I haven't sailed for 7 years. My license was the Second Mate Oceans Unlimited, and I had piloted for both Southeast and Southwest Alaska.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. So this slide is showing you... We've kind of explained to you why they stay here. Because they're not getting that here, this is where they're going, and this is why. So they're... So scheduling issues are very much a retention issue right now. So if you are held over for 2 weeks, for example, as a master who's held over for 2 weeks, he does his normal two-week assignment. He works for those 2 weeks he would have been off at overtime, and then he goes back to straight time and works a grand total of 6 weeks in a row. So that means that he works 504 hours in that six-week period with no day off. And only 2 weeks of it is eligible for overtime. So to put it another way, you end up working 350 hours per month in a calendar month, and you still have 144 hours to go before being relieved. That is something that is not necessarily uncommon in the maritime industry, but when it happens, the pay is significantly higher. The problem with AMHS is that you work here for the schedule, and the guys are not getting the schedules anymore. So I also want to make sure to emphasize that despite the fact that you are on overtime for part of it, overtime is not something that most of our members are looking for. They work here for the schedule. They work here for the time off. So although there is a small financial incentive, it's not enough to keep people around anymore. The guys would rather spend time with their families. And then I'm hoping that Erling can talk about untimely vacation approvals really quick.
Chair Hopkins, Erling Wally. Untimely vacation approvals. My members, most often or not, don't know that their vacations have been approved until the pay period crew list comes out, and they are not on it. We have CBA language, contract language, that says you'll turn it in 30 days before the pay period is posted, and the employer is supposed to notify you with 10 days after that, 20 days before the pay period has been posted. They're getting better, but for the most part, people don't know when they're getting off, so they can't plan their times off. And it's becoming it's becoming an issue enough to where people have walked away from this job.
Thank you, Mr. Wally. Considering we just went through four special sessions without knowing when they were going to be, I can understand that issue of walking away from this. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wally, I just need you to translate that a little bit. You used a bit of industry-specific terms. So are you saying you wouldn't know till 2 weeks prior that your vacation is approved? Or would you know 1 week prior? Because it's unclear what a pay period approval time frame is.
Through the chair, Representative Hannah. So the pay periods are set up to follow the pay period dispatching is set up to follow the end of the pay period. So it's, if a pay period ends on Friday, you'll see the pay period posted on the pay period crew list posted on a Wednesday. What the contract language says is that you're, as an employee, required 30 days prior to that posting to put in for a vacation request, and that the employer is supposed to respond to you within 20 days of that pay period crew listing posting. What our members have found out is that they don't receive approval until that pay period crew list comes out. They see they're not on the crew list, then they know that they're on approved vacation.
Thank you.
Through answer the question.
Well, we're getting closer. I'm still talking from the civilian world, and you're using terms that I – so now you're saying I wouldn't necessarily know the pay period crew list came out on Wednesday to start on Friday, so I know 48 hours in advance that my vacation that I requested 30 days ago has been approved because I'm not on the list for that shift that starts in 48 hours. Is that what I heard you say?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, the pay period crew list comes out on a Wednesday, and it covers the next coming pay period. So depending on when the vessels are, it's usually the way it's set, scheduled right now, if the crew list comes out on a Wednesday, you're going to work on Sunday. That's the first sailing of the Matanuska would be a Sunday, because that's the vessel that's running right now. So you would know 5 days in advance whether or not you were going to be on holiday.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, so go back up to the extension, the increased work schedules from holdovers and callbacks. You get premium pay for that? So you're obviously responsible for a certain amount of, whether it be the 144 hours or something like that, but when they hold you over, when the ferry's late, when something happens, is there a premium associated with that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I'm sorry, I'm trying to understand your question. Are you saying, is there a premium pay attached to the 2 weeks that you're held over?
Well, so just to give you an example, if I fly an airplane to China and my airplane breaks and I'm stuck there for an extra couple days and it goes into my days off, what would have been my days off, I obviously have to stay there with the airplane and bring it back. I get paid extra. I get premium pay.
Correct.
So I'm wondering if this has premium pay associated with it or if you guys are just screwed.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, there is premium pay associated with it when the state asks you to extend your dispatch past that specific regular two-week assignment. However, in the instance that you're talking about, if they did their 2 weeks of overtime and they were impacted during their 2 weeks of overtime, there's no premium during that 2 weeks of overtime when the state had asked you to stay to begin with. It only applies to any straight time that you would have been on.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, perfect. So I'm sorry, I should have done, this is Shannon Adamson for the record. So continuing on, we talk about lack of year-round work in a lot of instances. This is a huge retention issue, particularly for the IBU employees who are overworked in the summers and then laid off in the winters. We think if there was steady, predictable work, you might see more people sticking around. The payroll issues are something that we're currently discussing in negotiations, so I'm not sure how detailed I can get into this one.
Stay high level.
Stay high level. Understood. So we're running into issues with payroll adjusting timesheets in ways that impact retention. The employees are working a specific amount of time, and the amount of pay does not reflect that, and that is a retention issue as well. This sleep schedule is... So it's one of my pet peeves from when I was still sailing. As a watch stander for everybody but MEBA, you work a 6 hour on, 6 hour off schedule, which means that you're still working 12 hours a day, but your shifts are in 6 hour chunks for a watch stander. There are instances, especially for IBU, for the unlicensed divisions, where daily overtime is in addition to those hours. So the largest amount of time that you actually have a chance to get some sleep is maybe 5 hours at any given time, and then trying to do it in that rotation is difficult, to say the least. The Coast Guard has reports that has proven that it has a negative health impact. I think with a different schedule, there would be a better chance of retention.
Representative McCabe had a question on that.
Thanks. So a couple of the issues I see on this slide are grievances. Right. I mean, payroll issues.
Filed out of grievances or like concern issues that with the CBA.
Well, they should be grievances with the CBA. I mean, a payroll issue, if they're supposed to pay you at some period of time, if it's in your CBA and they don't do it, it's a grievance, right? I mean, you file a grievance. So same thing with vacation approvals, untimely vacation approvals. We had a set period of time when vacation was approved, and if it wasn't, it was a grievance. And so I'm curious, it kind of reminds me, and I have one more follow-up after this, but how many grievances do you guys have filed over these issues, the payroll issues and the vacation issues and that sort of thing?
Through the chair, the Representative McCabe, the amount of grievances we have filed at any given point obviously fluctuates. I know for a fact right now MEBA has 16 grievances outstanding regarding these particular specific issues. I think MMP has somewhere in the ballpark of 8 to 10. I don't know if Erling knows the answer to that one, but yes, you are right. We file grievances on a regular basis regarding contract violations, and the time frames in order to do responses are something that we're having an issue with. That's something we're discussing in negotiations as well.
That's a lot of grievances. Representative McCabe.
So one more question, and shifting gears a little bit. Thank you, Chair Hopkins. Sleep schedule. So the FAA for airline pilots has recently gone to what's called a fatigue risk management sort of safety management system. 6 hours on, 6 hours off wouldn't cut it for an airline pilot. So is there anything that you can do through the Coast Guard, or is the Coast Guard possibly looking at that? Because obviously you would need more than 6 hours to reset. So it's a near and dear to my heart, because that's what I kind of did in the last in my last job. So
through the chair, I agree it's near and dear to my heart as well, because I worked the schedule for a while, and it was always daunting, and I was in my 20s when I did it, so I can't imagine the guys that have been doing it for a lot longer. The issues that we run into, the historical basis for the 6 hours on, 6 hours off, is actually from when the ferry system started in the 60s, before we realized the detriment that does. My understanding is that the Coast Guard's intent for maintaining that schedule is that we would do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and you would get the opportunity to reset. Without the opportunity to reset on your home time, the Coast Guard has been starting to examine whether or not six or six schedules are something that they're going to continue to maintain. This is, again, something that we've brought up in negotiations, but because the Coast Guard hasn't come to a firm decision on it, we haven't gotten anywhere in negotiations on it.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. We've got 10 slides left in about 25 minutes. Yeah, 25 minutes. So
move it up.
We do have a question from Representative Hannah before that, though.
Thank you. I apologize, but I do want to understand the sleep schedule 6x6 is both in contract and Coast Guard regs, or if I were a pilot on the cruise ship, is it 6x6, or if I'm in the merchant marine industry? But within domestic waters where the Coast Guard controls that, is it 6x6? So is it industry-wide, or is it was set by the Coast Guard for AMHS and could be modified by contract?
Through the chair, the answer to your question is it is currently in the contract language for specific job positions in all three contracts, unless I'm mistaken. The Coast Guard allowed AMHS to operate on a 6x6 schedule. They gave them the approval for that in the 60s, and it has never been corrected since.
One follow-up.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that, do you know what the standard is in other, like the pilots in Southeast Alaska? Are they doing a 6x6, or is the cruise industry use something that resembles what we now know about sleep patterns being very significant in fatigue and accidents?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the pilots work a straight 12-hour schedule. The way that AMHS is able to operate this and still meet the Coast Guard requirements is something called work-rest regulations, which means that you can't work more than now I'm trying to remember. I might have to get you some more information about that. There's a specific number of hours per week that you're not allowed to go over. So it doesn't cover a daily schedule. It covers a weekly schedule. But I can get you some more info on that one.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I'm sorry, and then Erling Wally just told me that he has 36 outstanding grievances just for
36? Okay.
Wow. Yes.
That's enough.
I had 300.
You had 300?
Yeah.
At one time?
Yes.
I think my max was 14 or something, so, and that was one time, and I got 1,000 people I work for. Yeah. You guys need a better payroll system. Please proceed.
Okay, I'm just, again, for the record, this is Shannon Adamson. The wages aren't keeping up with inflation. Both MMP and IBU have only had 6% increases over the last 10 years. So the MEVA members have had no wage increase since 2017. And then just for some reference, the urban Alaska inflation rate, according to the Department of Labor's website, has been 16% over that time frame. And then the lack of communication and respect is something that we're seeing on a regular basis. That helps facilitate low morale in the fleet, which is another reason why the guys are saying they are not staying. They feel like their input or opinions are not valued.
Thank you, Ms. Adamson. One thing that Representative Stutes has brought up a lot is the RSVs, like the onboard ship requests or onboard maintenance requests. Are those things where they feel that their opinions are not being valued to listen to and is frustrating? Are there other things? Because I saw you have a slide of a lot of the public opinion that was customer survey responses. But are those the type of things that are not being accepted and listened to?
Yeah, Chair Hopkins, the short answer to that question is yes. SMRs, which are ship maintenance requests, are a direct result of the crew members trying to present information to the office that is routinely ignored, but that's not the only way it happens.
All right. Thank you. Now you can go on.
Okay, perfect. So where are they going? With the qualifications that our individuals hold, and without the schedule to hold them to AMHS, they have a lot of options. If the schedule was the reason you stayed and you're close to retirement, you're going to choose to retire, and they are, to spend time with their families. Other companies inside the West Coast, Washington State Ferries, Blackball, Crowley Tugs, are all doing aggressive recruitment campaigns and offering, I don't think Blackball is offering bonuses, but and in most instances offering hiring bonuses to incentivize people to come. So I covered this before, but sailing offshore companies tends to have fewer days off than AMHS does. The schedule is not as appealing, but the offshore companies in most instances pay as much as double.
Representative Seuss had a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just where is Blackball?
So Blackball, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Seuss, Blackball is a ferry that operates between Sydney, British Columbia, and I can't remember what the port is in Washington, but Washington State.
Port Angeles.
Thank you. Port Angeles in Washington State. We actually talk about Blackball a little bit further on, too, but Blackball is a great comparison to AMHS in that the Coho, which is the Blackball's ferry, is a sister ship to the Tuckett.
Representative Hannah, are you done? Representative Stutes?
Thank you.
Cool. Representative Hannah.
And is Black, through the chair, is Blackball a private ferry, or it's what the BC ferry system is called?
My understanding is it's a private ferry.
Just the one route?
Just the one route.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Please proceed.
And Erling, did you want to talk about Crowley, or do you want to just push on?
Push on.
Again, further places they're going. Because Ben is not here, and I'm not as familiar with his union hall, I will leave those particular ones alone, but I will spend a little bit of time talking about the pilots associations. So there's three in the state of Alaska, and all three of these, the Southeast Alaska Pilots Association, the Southwest Alaska Pilots Association, and the Alaska Marine Pilots, all three of these operate in areas that are the same or have overlap with AMHS, which means that if you are a permanent full-time master or chief mate with AMHS, you already have the pilotage for a lot of these areas. Hmm. So it makes the transition pretty seamless. The licensure is very comparable. These have always been very desirable gigs. The difference is that now that they see the same mariner shortage that we do, their openings are significantly increased. And they're cherry picking all of my chief mates and masters. It's annoying. when you work for CEPA, that you work for 6 months of the year and you make almost quadruple what you make with AMHS.
Wow. Thank you.
And then we get into Blackball. So you get to have a visual representation of what these boats are like. There are a lot of similarities between these three companies. So these companies operate similar vessels or have similar license requirements. In Blackball's case, there is a similar assignment schedule in that you do it as an 84-hour rotation, which is similar to AMHS. They do 168 hours a month. They just do it in 84-hour chunks.
Representative McCabe.
And thanks, and maybe you're going to get to this. I'm just looking at the average masters, 23% more, chief mates, 27% more, and on Blackball, 48% more and such. Is that just the base pay, or is that the total what you bring home at the end of the year? Having negotiated a number of these, I know that there are tons and tons of soft rules which is where you make your money. You don't necessarily make your money on the hourly pay. You make your money on the extension pay, on the extra duty time, on the overtime pay, on the any one of 100 things, staying in a hotel, those sorts of things. So I wonder if this 23% and this 41%, if that's aggregate total pay, if you've gone in and looked and see what a Blackball master brings home total at the end of the year, even gross pay, if you compare gross pay to gross pay, that's how you kind of get past the soft rules when you're looking at various union contracts. So I guess I'm wondering what this is. Is this just wages or is this everything?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, the short answer to your question is this is just wages. We're going to spend just a couple minutes talking about coal, travel, and which one am I missing? And leave in one of the next slides. But this particular information is just straight hourly wages comparisons.
One follow-up, Madam Vice Chair. Okay. Thank you. So do you have a comparison that shows end-to-end this is what a master makes at Black Ball for a year, and this is what he makes at Marine Highway? Do you have that comparison?
Not on me, but I can provide it to you.
Okay, that'd be great. Yeah, I'm intensely interested because oftentimes this type of entity gets sold a bill of goods that says they make 23% more of us, and that's not really true because you've been so successful in negotiations in years past that you have a ton of soft rules. That's where you make your money. So I'm interested in the total, and I think it speaks for itself. With so many people leaving, obviously there's a problem there. But
thank you. And as long as you're going to do that information request, when you're including that Canadian-based company, I'd like to know what their health care cost contribution are, because I'm going to assume for the Canadians it doesn't come out of their they're not having to buy that in, and that the members of the AMHS employee are having a health care cost in their wages. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Is Black Ball Ferry a private ferry line?
Yes.
Not state-owned?
Correct.
Thank you.
And then I want to make sure I'm sorry.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, I'm just wondering if any of the Washington State ferries do anything other than commuter transport.
Through the chair, the short answer to that question is not really. I think their longest runs tend to run 4 to 6 hours, and the vast majority of their stuff is commuter, not necessarily long distance based like we tend to be.
So that crew goes home every night?
Correct.
Or at the end of their shift? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
I want to make sure I draw attention to a typo. I apologize for this one. In the top red box on the right-hand side, the Black Ball second mate versus AMHS master, that's supposed to be an 8.9%, not 108.9%. That's a little bit outside of the realm. However, the Black Ball second engineer to chief engineer is accurate. So those are the ones that I wanted to draw your attention to. So a second mate with Black Ball, so two levels below a master, makes 9% more than a master with AMHS, and a second engineer at Black Ball makes 31.6% more than a chief engineer with AMHS. Which is what you're going to see in this slide. So this does a comparison for masters at each specific job classification in comparison to each of those companies that they work for. As Representative McCabe covered, this does not cover things like COLD, which is the cost of living differential. If you are an in-state Alaskan, you get a cost of living differential to live in-state. It is a lump sum that is paid per paycheck. For masters, it is somewhere in the ballpark of $400. For a third mate, it's somewhere in the ballpark of $250. I want to make sure we acknowledge that we do earn. I'm sorry, I thought Representative Stutes was waving. we also do earn significantly more leave, and the reason that we do have a higher leave accumulation is because of how we use it. So with most of these companies, when you take a day off, you have the ability to take a day off, especially with something like Washington State Ferries, because you're home every night. With us, if you take a day off, you have to be replaced for the entire dispatch. Mm. So if we get a cold and we need to take 3 days off, which is a significant problem in regards to navigation, because your physical capacity for emergencies is something that the Coast Guard closely monitors. So if you are not able to do a regular watch rotation or provide those emergency duties, you have to be replaced. And if you are replaced, you're replaced for your entire dispatch, which is in theory 168 hours.
And then you're forced to take the leave for the 168 hours.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. When you're replaced, you are replaced for the entire 168 hour chunk, or 84 hour chunk if you're doing IBU.
Great. Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Chair Hopkins, thanks. Sorry, I was thinking about whether
we had about 10 minutes left.
Okay. Yeah. If you call in sick like that for a cold for 3 days and you get replaced on a 168-hour trip, you said something about you have to take vacation?
Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative McCabe. I'm sorry, you have to take the time off. It can be, we do have both sick leave and vacation accruals.
Okay.
But you do have to take that time off. However, if you're not physically sick during that time, so if you get a cold for 3 days and the doctor signs you off as a three-day cold, the rest of the time that you were off the vessel is used as vacation, not as the 3 days of sick leave.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. So without Ben here, I can do like a quick comparison for so for your information, Washington State Ferries only has one category for assistant engineers. So in order to make it so that the numbers were comparable, we put that number into the first assistant engineer, which is why there is a green bar missing for the seconds. Blackball chief engineers make almost double what AMHS chief engineer makes, and Washington State Ferries assistant engineers earn significantly more than AMHS chief engineers. And then this one is for Erling.
Mr. Wall, are you there?
Chair Hopkins, yes, I am.
Fantastic. You're up.
Yeah, we reflected just the bosun, the AB, and the cooks. WSF does not have any stewards, but Blackball does. So we compare it to $40 an hour versus the $30 as a cook on the Marine Highway. Bosuns, $40 versus $32. ABs, you know, just under $40 versus just under $30 for the able-bodied seamen. So there is a discrepancy. You know, you can see we're a little behind, not as prominent as MMP and MEBA, but we're a little behind the eight ball as far as our wage scales per industry average.
Thank you.
Okay, so this one, I'm going to end up spending just a little bit of time on. I apologize. So we know the slide is crowded, but we wanted to make sure we show the amount of suggestions that have been made by the unions over the years to address the crisis that we currently find ourselves in. Working crew members year-round, we've talked about that one a lot. Utilizing union halls for certain positions. The upside to this is that it is short-term work, which means it can be used in emergencies to keep vessels sailing. It doesn't involve a full-time crew member investment.
Hold on one second. Representative Seuss had a question on that.
But they would have to have all the licenses, so wouldn't they?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Seuss, yes. But what happens is the crew members, in this instance, the marine engineers are the ones that currently are doing it. They maintain their licenses, and then they sail out of a union hall, which means that jobs are posted on a board, and they get to determine and choose which of those jobs they would like.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you. Follow-up. Can you work down? Instead of, you know, so if you're a captain on a boat and you need some extra dough, can you get on as a car deck guy?
The short answer to your question, Representative Stutz, is no. You can work down, but you have to stay inside your bargaining unit.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So we need to figure out ways to address payroll and labor relations issues. Again, I don't want to get too far into this one because we're in negotiations, but this will have a huge impact on retention and AMHS's reputation inside the industry. Erling, I'm going to skip union dispatching and come back to it since I've got a momentum going. One of the larger ones I want to draw attention to is adjusting AMHS-determined minimum qualifications. Right now, the only thing that is preventing that from happening is AMHS management is not doing it. It can help facilitate. There are specific qualifications that are not Coast Guard required that are AMHS required that are standing in the way of entry-level positions taking permanent jobs. I have no clue why they're not doing it.
And that goes back to your earlier slides talking about all the entry. Okay, thank you. Representative Stutz.
Can you give us a couple examples of what those might be?
Yeah,
please. Thank you through the chair.
Although Erling, I'm sure, could get into further details. So, for example, an entry-level full-time permanent stewards positions has I'm going to make everybody dizzy and go back for a little while. Has a specific amount of qualifications that are required to sail in those sail or work in yards in those positions. And then in addition to that, there are AMHS specific qualifications. Ooh, this one works. So in order to sail as a bosun, you need the qualifications that are in that first round of bullet points. The AMHS specific qualifications are not Coast Guard required. Although we should definitely talk about trying to utilize them as much as possible in order to fill positions, we can utilize those members in those positions without those qualifications without violating Coast Guard standards.
Thank you. Thank you.
Erling, did I miss anything?
No, Shannon, you got it.
Okay, perfect. So, and then going back to setting up a training fund for the entry-level positions. So the thought is that you can offer them some sort of training fund for a specific year commitment, which is something that we're seeing as an industry standard in recruitment incentive options right now. The shipyard issues that we're running into are generally across the board, but there's ways to incentivize crew members to continue working in shipyards and keep them working year-round. You can have them. IBU works a very different schedule in yards than the licensed divisions do. We maintain our schedules in yards. We maintain our 2x2 schedules in yards. The licensed guys, they shrink down the amount of people that are required, and they change their schedules. If we maintained the specific schedule through the yards, the guys would have more predictability and should be able to work more year-round schedules. And then AMHS used to recruit at job fairs and high schools and maritime academies, and they stopped doing that about 10 years ago. And I can kind of understand why at the time with the oil prices being what they were, but there's nothing that prevents us from going back, and I have no idea why we haven't.
When did they stop doing that?
I think when 7 or 8 years ago when the oil prices
were. Okay, when it dropped out in 14 or so. Okay.
I'm sorry, yes.
No, that's good. Thank you.
Okay, so collective bargaining agreements. We have heard in a lot of presentations by DOT that our contracts are unusually complicated and hard to administer. We want to make sure that we address that. So these contracts, instead of viewing them as state employee contracts, it's easier to view them as industry standard contracts. So some of the benefits are going to differ from other state employees. For example, travel pay. I know that's one that happens on a regular basis. It's brought up inside legislative meetings. Travel pay is an industry standard. If you put a job on a union board and you do not pay them to get to that job or pay their airfare to and from, a person is not going to take that job. That is an industry standard. If we do away with travel pay or limit it, you're going to see an even bigger exodus than we currently have. That's one of those industry standard provisions inside the contract that might be hard to understand unless you understand the industry itself. So I would argue that our contracts are not complicated when you compare them to industry standard contracts, but they are complicated when you compare them to state contracts. But there are things that are in state contracts that are not in ours. For example, the three maritime unions are the only represented groups inside the state that do not get step and merit, which means that we don't get wage increases unless we specifically negotiated them. Every other group gets 3 or 3.25% every 2 to 3 years, depending on where they are in their specific cycle. We do not get that guaranteed raise. And then I want to make sure and address the fact that these contracts, although there are some instances in it where the language could be considered a little archaic, we are willing to discuss changes to those language if the state is interested. That's how negotiations works. But at the same time, they're based off of 60 years of bargaining, and they're based off of industry standard contracts. So not every provision that's in them is going to be something that we have the ability to change while maintaining our workforce.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is the part where I get to do my kind of kumbaya thing, which is we have been trying to explain to the state for 10 years now that the crew members are an amazing resource and a way for change to be made both shoreside and on the vessels, and we would love the opportunity. Both the unions who negotiate the contracts and the members that work in those positions would love the opportunity to figure out a way to work together to create solutions. Right now, we're not being utilized, and that's just sad. For example, I have a member named Scott McCauley. I'm sure he's going to love that I just put his name on the record, has sailed with AMHS since 1983. He's coming up on 40 years of service with AMHS. He is a fountain of knowledge that we're not utilizing. There's another member that works for IBU that got hired at the same time. She's a purser right now. She is another fountain of knowledge, especially in regards to the fact that she gets to see the amount of dollars that come through her specific vessel at any given point. We want to be able to be considered something that a group that can be worked with to create solutions. There are a million ideas out there, and if even one of them is actually useful, it's worth talking to them about. We did have a meeting with DOT and Labor Relations yesterday, and we brainstormed some ideas to try and create solutions to help. We're hopeful, but I wouldn't necessarily hold my breath because it's got to go through so many bureaucracy channels to get to solutions. So the next really big thing that we want to make sure that we talk about is we really need to be doing something to fill these vessels. The boats run whether they're 20% full or 90% full. Why aren't we trying to run them 90% full? Why aren't we doing everything we can to run them at as close to capacity as possible? The other ways we can have conversations is to improve the shipboard experience. I don't know if anybody remembers this. The boats used to do misty fjords and Glacier Bay trips. And every time the boats did one of those trips, usually it was coming from yards or going to yards, so it didn't impact service. And every time they did those, the ships sold out. They were always packed to the gills. We should be trying to utilize those kind of things as well. Improving the shipboard experience, we can have coffee bars that are in the same place that the original gift shops were. We're not going to utilize any other space. And that's something that I think the passengers would enjoy. We currently have internet on board the boat. Turn it into Wi-Fi and ask them to pay for it. Increase the shipboard experience and fill the boats. We really need to put butts in seats. And then the last one is you've got these employees that are that have those 40 years of experience. Let them help. Treat them like valued members of a team and not hindrances or afterthoughts, which is what they feel like they are now. Include them in decision making and utilize their experience. Okay, so we don't necessarily have to stay on this slide. I just wanted to show some instances where the crew members have gone above and beyond and they've gotten some really good feedback. We're really proud of our members and the work we do, and we just wanted to acknowledge that. And then I'm very proud of myself because I'm wrapping up right around the right time. So we want to be considered partners in solutions, and we want to encourage the legislators to contact us with any questions regarding the members of the contracts that they might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Adamson. Anybody in Burt who needs to run are free to run. My quick question, though, we were looking at, you know, a total restructuring of the Marine Highway System with the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board, the AMHOB. How has that been received by these three bargaining units and your participation in it, and how's that going for you after their one meeting so far?
The first meeting went great. I'm sorry, through the chair. We're hopeful and would like to be included as much in that as possible. I'm a little bit nervous in it in that it's still an advisory committee, and DOT can choose whether or not they want to listen to those advices, although I do love the fact that there is overseeing from the legislature for that. I think that was an amazing addition to what MTAB had before. I'm hoping that DOT will utilize them as much as humanly possible. The person that we put, that ended up in the union position on the board is a current serving master with AMHS, which gives him a lot of great operational feedback. He doesn't necessarily have as much of the union experience that regarding negotiations or scheduling committee stuff that we would have preferred, but we're kind of cautiously optimistic and hopeful that those suggestions that the group makes will make a serious impact. I know the conversations regarding recruitment and retention are among the, not next meeting, but the meeting after, and we're really hopeful that there'll be some good discussion there.
I certainly hope so, too. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for that presentation today and the solid questions and discussions we have. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 1st at 1 p.m. right here. We'll have the schedule finalized and posted by the end of the workday today or this week, I believe today because it's due by 4 o'clock. Are there any additional questions for the committee at this time? Doesn't look like it. Thanks, everybody. We're adjourned today at 3:04 in the p.m.